Hello, all Nina Porzuki here, and you are listening to The World in Words, where we talk about all things language on this podcast, like how filmmaker David Thorpe recently took to the streets to find out...
Do I sound gay?
Yes, I think you do sound gay. Not as much as I do, but...
Yes. Yes.
No. En français, no. En English, I don't know.
Yes.
Not at all.
Really?
Your tone, which is like intellectual, so people can read it as gay.
I would have just maybe lumped you in the artsy fartsy.
Sound creative.
You have like the S in the front of the mouth, which is part of the gay man stereotype.
There is something slightly melodic.
I think it's the nasality.
I would definitely rate you as a metrosexual.
No.
Not at all.
No.
You sound like a human being male.
Je sais pas. Je sais pas, on se connaît pas assez.
It's perhaps more the fact that I'm gay as well, so I kind of pick up on that.
You don't sound like gay, maybe because I'm steeped in gay.
You could sound gay if you wanted to make it a very, very cast a very wide net.
We enunciate. And if that's gay, mwah.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.
David Thorpe's documentary, Do I Sound Gay, is out now in theaters. And he investigates the stereotypes surrounding the, quote, gay voice. One of the experts that he consults is linguist Ron Smythe. Smythe has studied the gay voice extensively at the University of Toronto. He's actually just retired and is now living down in Argentina. And that's where I caught up with him. I was curious to learn a little bit more about how he got into this type of research and to see how this stereotype actually translates around the globe.
Well, it was a question that I've had in my mind all my life. I mean, most people wonder about how their voices sound. And when we hear ourselves on a recording, we go, oh, my God, do I sound like that? So when we were approached at the University of Toronto by a fellow named Greg Jacobs from York University, he came down to talk to me and to my colleague, Hank Rogers, who's a phonetician. And I'm a psycholinguist, so I design experiments and I know how to analyze them. And Greg was more of a queer theory kind of person. He didn't have the scientific background, but we made a great team, the three of us together. We would meet every week and we started running experiments and getting research grants and publishing. And it's been a fascination for me ever since.
But why were you interested in the gay voice?
Greg had done a literature review on the gay voice, and there was almost nothing. And so we started re-examining everything from scratch, thinking, like, is it really true that gay men talk this way, or could it be the case that there are straight men who talk this way? Because we do hear about straight men who sound gay, and then they're accused of being gay. You know, you might know somebody a woman whose husband sounds gay. And so we just thought, we don't really know anything about this, which is why we started doing the experiments, to find out not only scientifically speaking, what it's all about. But also, I think all three of us, because we're all gay, we're wondering about our own voices too.
Do you feel in your own head, do you sound gay, or have you gotten that before growing up?
Oh, yeah. I was a sissy boy, and I was mocked by schoolyard bullies, and they would imitate my sissy way of speaking. And, you know, I've never put my own voice into these panels of judges to see where it sits on the scale of 1 to 7, but I think I'm well above the middle.
7 being the most, quote-unquote, gay-sounding, 1 being...
Yeah, the best voice.
Getting back to sort of the gay voice and the research you were doing, I think the interesting distinction is that you were actually doing this about the stereotypes of the gay voice, but there actually isn't a correlation, which you found in your research, between sounding gay and being gay.
Right.
Which is an important
distinction. Correlation is either completely absent or only a weak one. Not at all what people might think, that the gay voices are gay men.
Did you go in thinking that, or is that a surprising discovery for you?
It's a funny thing. The first thing we looked at was pitch, because the stereotype says gay men have high voices. And in fact, actors, when they play gay roles, often implement their character by speaking in a higher voice. This has been measured by my student, Emily Blaymeyer. So some actors simply think, well, to talk gay, I'll have to talk in a higher voice. Not true. In our first experiment, the correlation between being gay and speaking with a higher voice was 0. The correlation between sounding gay and speaking with a higher voice was 0. There's nothing going on there of interest whatsoever. No correlation. What we do find, however, when we did other kinds of measurements, like differences in L, like la-la-la, or the strength of aspiration, Peter, longer P's, things like that, these all correlated with how gay the voice sounded. They didn't correlate with whether the guy was gay or straight.
So whether people are picking up on the stereotype, so whether they hit the stereotype of gay voice.
Yeah, so it really shows that the stereotype is out there, because listeners agree on who sounds gay, but they're wrong about the fact that they are gay.
That is extremely interesting. So when we're talking linguistically, can you explain what sounds gay stereotypically to people?
Okay. Aspiration of consonants being longer, vowels in a word being stretched out longer,
like
final consonants being strongly aspirated, like continent as opposed to continent, which you see in the film. David's in my lab at the University of Toronto saying continent, and I point that out to him. Vowel articulation. So when we pronounce vowels in English, women tend to hit the target much more clearly. Men tend to undershoot the target. So men's vowels are not as crisp and clear, as clearly articulated as women's. And what I'm actually driving at now is that these differences that are between gay and straight-sounding voices are the same differences that we find between the average male and the average female voice. So roughly speaking, and it's certainly not 100% true, but what sounds gay is often speaking with the versions of the speech sounds that women more typically use. And these are what we call micro-variation. They're not terribly obvious, which is why we have to do acoustic analysis to measure them, but they certainly have an effect on the perception of the voice sounding gay.
Wow. And I wonder how, looking at this, how does that happen? How do male take on more feminine voices? How do females, and I'm assuming, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, have you done research on women's voices as well, sounding
Yes,
more,
with women's
unquote,
voices, I've done a big study of vowel pronunciation along with men's voices, and we found that a language change in progress in Canada involving vowels was working in the direction of young women pronouncing the vowels the newer way, and men who sound gay also doing that. But straight men and women who sound lesbian were resisting this language change. So we do know something about women, and it seems to be the same kind of thing. So you asked me about the origin of the gay voice?
Yeah.
Well, as far as we can determine, it has to do more with your gender identity as opposed to your sexuality. So gender identity means that you tend towards in the case of a gay-sounding man, you tend towards affiliating yourself with women and girls and using them as your role model. An amazing study by a fellow named Peter Wren from 2002 looked at a large number of men, both gay and straight. He interviewed them along with their mothers about their behavior when they were kids.
Huh.
And he found a big range in terms of whether the kids acted more masculine or more feminine, cross-gender behavior, as he put it. And so on a scale of 1 to 7 of the amount of cross-gender behavior the boy used when he was young, we find that that correlates with the way he speaks now as an adult. The more he was interested in feminine things when he was young, the more likely he is to sound gay. And that suggests that he was using female input when he was just first learning to pronounce English. But the amazing thing in that study was that there was no correlation between cross-gender behavior and being gay.
Right, which backs up exactly what your research has been as well.
Right. So I do like to put a little bit of a rider on this. There is some small amount of reality to the correlation between being gay and sounding gay. In a recent study on Italian and German, they did find that the men who were most likely to be rated as very gay were more often gay men, but there were straight men in there too. And at the other end of the scale, the ones who were butch sounding were slightly more often straight men than gay men. But this is a very weak effect. You can't really predict who's gay by their voice. You're taking a big risk if you're going to draw a firm conclusion from listening to a man's voice.
I wonder if you could just take me personal for a little bit. When you say you grew up with a sissy voice, and I know you have a brother, does he also how did that personally affect you when you think about your relationship with your parents? Where do you fall in that?
Yeah, well, my father was relatively absent from the home. He worked on the railroad and he had many interests outside the home. So my brother would play with the boys in the neighborhood, and when my dad was home, they would get along just fine. I, in the same household, was enthralled by listening to my mother's phone calls with her girlfriends, watching her bake, fix her hair, things like that. And I had a sister, too, Marilyn, who's still with us, and she was part of my input, as well as my cousin Lorraine. I hung out with girls, and at school, when all the boys were playing baseball, I was playing dodgeball with the girls and skipping. So I see my childhood as being populated by girls and women and me paying a lot of attention to them. My brother was uninterested in those things. He was playing with his cars and out playing baseball and stuff. And we would come home to the same home, and there you would see one sissy-sounding boy and one non-sissy-sounding boy because of that.
So when you started doing this research and you started finding out the correlations between gender identity and the way that you sound, did it put things into place for you personally?
Absolutely. I right away recognized that, you know, what is it to be a sissy boy? I was a sissy because I was hanging out with girls and doing girly things and, you know, being interested in the same things that girls are interested in. And therefore, it made perfect sense that my strong association with girls when I was young would affect my speech. We all use role models to decide, unconsciously usually, how we're going to pronounce our language. And so they were my input. My brother in the same household wasn't paying attention to my sister and my mother as a trigger for how to speak. He was paying attention to the other boys and men. It all became clear to me now. And, you know, it made it perfectly clear that this is not just some genetic thing. It's socially acquired. I don't speak the way I speak, and I didn't speak the way I spoke back then, because of some gay voice gene. No, it was because my personality is more one that tends to like to do what are stereotypically female things. But, you know, when we talk about straight men with gay voices, there are lots of men who love to spend time in the kitchen, mm-hmm. people who are highly verbal, who like to have social interactions with women, and, you know, the reasons why a straight man would have a gay-sounding voice have to do with the same thing, what interest in stereotypically female things that put you into contact with women and trigger your language acquisition with them as the model.
I wonder if you can just put this in a global perspective for me, because we're talking a lot about North American gay voice, but how does this work out in other languages and other cultures around the world? Is there a quote-unquote gay voice in other places?
Early on in this research, I interviewed all the graduate students in the linguistics department at the University of Toronto who were from another country and spoke another language. And this question that I asked them was simply, are there men who sound gay in your country? And if so, how do they speak? Almost every single one of them said yes, and they speak more like women. So it's not that there's a specific way of pronouncing things. It just depends on what is considered female speech in that language.
So it's not necessarily the sibilant S is a demarcation of sounding gay all over the world.
It wouldn't be so in all languages, because if in some language, the sociolinguistics or sociophonetic facts are that women produce a more retracted S farther back in your mouth, or do anything that's opposite to what we do in English. If that's associated with female in that language, then that would be the thing that the young boys who are associating with women would pick up on. So the universal aspect is that it has to do with who your role models are, and then the secondary thing is what sounds feminine, your language. That study by the Italian group that came out just last week showed that Italian speakers, like English speakers, are very poor at guessing who's gay from their voice, and so are German speakers. So it's certainly been replicated in other languages like Brazilian Portuguese and so on. This is a fact that people do agree what sounds gay. So in their study, they looked also at Italian speakers listening to German and rating the voices on gayness, and German speakers listening to Italian and rating the voices on gayness. And it was kind of weird. They didn't quite know how to explain this at first, that the Germans thought Italian sounded gayer than German does, and the opposite happened in the opposite direction. So across languages, they weren't in such agreement in the same way as the native speakers were. If Germans think that Italian sounds more gay, obviously what they're doing is picking up on what there is in Italian that in German would sound gay. But it's not German, it's Italian, and it doesn't sound gay in Italian. So they're not very good at doing the ratings for a language that they don't speak. And this matches perfectly with my suggestion that it depends on what sounds gay in the language. You might not know what sounds gay in another language. For example, I said recently to someone, I have no idea what gay sounds like in Vietnamese. Vietnamese has some very, very different phonetic properties, and I'm sure there will be male-female differences in Vietnamese, and I'm sure that the boys who like to hang out with girls more will speak that way, but Vietnamese is so incredibly different from English that I can't tell you what it would be that would be female unless I go and study the language. I'm not going to say it's the same things that happen in English.
So it's completely dependent on the culture of which you're brought up in, which makes total sense. And speaking of culture, I think one of the most interesting parts of the film for me was talking about how the gay voice has been cultivated throughout films from the 1920s to the Disney movies. There's a lot of examples of the Disney movies like Scar from The Lion King. And he uses a sibilant S.
Yes.
And he has a more feminine sounding voice.
Well, as far as brains go, I got the lion's share, but when it comes to brute strength, I'm afraid I'm at the shallow end of the gene pool.
It's a super insidious thing. I had actually never stopped to consider the voices of some of these quote-unquote evil
insidious
characters.
Insidious is the perfect word, and it's the word that comes to mind to me, too, because there's some correlation in somebody's mind somewhere in the movie industry that evil and bad and gay all go together, which is such an antiquated view. But I was born in 1951, and I was raised with terrible stereotypes of what used to be called queers. You know, they were lurking in the dark alleys and in the washrooms at the cinema and stuff like that. It was just considered so bad and so unusual. I think about Mr. Burns on The Simpsons. He's sort of evil and nasty and non-masculine at the same time.
Right.
He's kind of supercilious and plotting, scheming, and he doesn't sound at all masculine. So my question for the movie industry would be, are you doing this because that's the way it's always been done since the 1920s? Are you doing this on purpose because you think that gay men are icky and you have to make the evil characters sound that way? I don't know their motivation for doing it, but as you said, it's rather insidious because it communicates something, especially to young children who are watching these things and figuring out what a nasty kind of person sounds like.
Well, it might be something that's just so deeply embedded in the culture that, like, you know, we began the interview by you saying, you know, actors, when they affect a gay voice, they go higher up, right? Higher register.
Yeah.
Well, where does that come
even
from?
Though it's not true that gay, even though it's not true that gay men speak with a higher voice.
Exactly. So where does that come from? So in the films, you know, a filmmaker might not be cognizant of, I am putting this sort of linguistic marker on this character.
You know, or the actor.
Or the actor.
You know, naturally, or the director directing the person to talk a different way.
I was listening or trying to go through pop culture and listen to how gay voice has been portrayed. And the one example that I was thinking that perhaps is a more maybe fair assessment of what your research is Will and Grace. Because Will, he doesn't have the effeminate, quote-unquote, gay voice. But then there is a character on the show that does.
Jack,
who does have that. Yeah. And I thought that was kind of an interesting balance, like in pop culture, to have both of those examples.
I've discovered a universe where your eggheadedness is celebrated and your feta cheese thighs are overlooked. It's the gay spelling bee.
Gay spelling bee?
It's a real spelling bee with gay contestants and gay words. Like flounce, hydrangea, set designed by. Come on, I need a coat.
Sorry, Jack, I'd love to, but my mom's...
Your first gay word is daiquiri.
I quit.
We received a grant from GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Discrimination, many years ago, to do a small study of the phonetics of Will and Jack on that show in two consecutive seasons. We did the acoustic analysis so we could do precise measurements of frequencies and so on, and durations, and sure enough, Jack, who's perceived as sounding more gay, I think everyone would agree with that, has all of those acoustic markers. And Will had only a couple of them. Huh. So Jack definitely sounded a lot gayer. Will was probably trying to be the straight-sounding lawyer, but he was playing a gay role, and he's a straight actor. And interestingly, in the second season, Will was sounding a little bit more gay than he was in the first season.
Oh,
Jack
really?
Was over the top throughout the entire series.
How did you feel about that series?
You know, stereotypes are not always very helpful. So on the one hand, as we said in our article that came out of that grant, there's Jack perpetuating a stereotype that is uncomfortable, as you can see from the very fact that David Thorpe made this film, right? Mm-hmm. Sounding gay is not always accepted by people in the society as good, right? On the other hand, as David pointed out, he tried to change his voice just to see how it would go, and the only things he picked up on was a way to make him sound a bit more authoritative, but he didn't give up his gay style of speech because he became comfortable with his identity. So when we saw Jack being such a gay stereotype, and not only in his speech, but in his effusive manner and the topics of conversation and his kind of airheadedness, this was, on the one hand, a bad stereotype because we don't want everyone to think that gay men are always like this. But on the other hand, it's an upfront person being what he is. And so on the other hand, it's good. So the contrast, though, is what was interesting, that at least this TV series showed that not all gay men are like Jack. There are gay men like Jack, and there are gay men like Will. And that's really one of my most important points.
Ron, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for your interest.
That was linguist Ron Smythe talking to us from Buenos Aires. Okay, for the last few podcasts, I have been begging you for your etymological inquiries. What nagging questions have you always had about the origin of a certain word?
I have linguist and writer Erica Okrent with me. She is keen to answer some of your questions. Hey, Erica, how you doing?
Hello. Hi.
So the word we're going to talk about today is disabled. And we got this question from listener Amy Wong. Dear Nina, I was wondering if you can find the etymology for the word disabled. As I am someone who is physically disabled, the term has various meanings to me, and I thought perhaps knowing the etymology would help in regards for it not being a social construct or label. So, Erica, disabled. What did you find out?
I was surprised because it wasn't exactly what I expected. I knew that sometime in the 70s, disabled had become the preferred term over handicapped. Mm-hmm. So I assumed that handicapped was the older term. That's usually how it goes. But that's not true.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Now, of course, disabled in a literal sense of meaning not able goes back very far. That first citation for that is from 1598. And it's first used for ships and oars, things that are rendered unable to be used or taken out of commission. And then after that, it extends to limbs. You have a disabled finger or leg, then a person. But already in 1740, it was used in this sense where they would say the disabled to speak of a whole group of people with disabilities.
Wow. So then what's the actual history of handicapped? When did that become associated with disabled, if it came after?
Well, handicapped also had a long history, going back to sports and horse racing. But it started being used for people in the 1880s. So disabled was there about 100 years before handicapped. And usually it's the older term that collects too many bad connotations over time. That's what happened with terms like crippled, which has been around since the 1400s. And then a new word takes its place to sort of get rid of those negative connotations and start anew. But that's not exactly what happened here.
Wow. So then, like, what exactly happened? Because how did handicap become the pejorative and disabled become the accepted term?
When disability rights activism took off in the 1970s, at that particular moment in time, handicapped had collected a bunch of wrong connotations for purposes of the movement from a completely different sort of background.
How do you mean?
Well, it had been chosen by well-meaning people in the social services system. So services for the deaf and blind, educational institutions, hospitals, they chose that word as a sort of nicer alternative to the terrible words like crippled and invalid that had been used before. And it was supposed to be more humane and polite. The problem was it wasn't chosen by the people it was supposed to refer to themselves. So it suggested a kind of helplessness and this need for kind saviors to come in and provide for them, do something for them. Now, disability rights activism was about self-determination, not a request for help or pity, but a demand that barriers to mobility, communication, hiring be taken down. And handicapped had this aura of, oh, poor handicapped people idea associated with it. Disabled at that point seemed a lot less patronizing. It had been a term used by veterans returning from the war who had sort of begun the disability rights movement, demonstrating for their rights. And so its connotations were more forthright and less kind of sugar-coated and patronizing. So disability activists chose it for themselves and gave it a new positive connotation.
That's really interesting. Now I've heard another term, differently abled, too, being used.
Some people in the movement consider those types of euphemisms a little patronizing, too, that it's sort of sugarcoating. And a really hated one is special, the term special. Now, there is a new movement to not call people disabled. You say a person who is disabled. You don't say the disabled as a group.
I've heard that with mental health too. Like someone isn't bipolar, they have bipolar disorder.
Right. Here's one thing about the person, not the totality of who they are and what their existence is. So that's been a change in terminology. These terms, they're always changing. They take on connotations that can be negative, but then a community can take them back and put their own connotations on it by the way they use it. And that's what's happened with the term disabled, a very old word that has now taken on new positive connotations started by the people who it's supposed to refer to.
Well, there you have it, disabled. Thank you so much, Erica, for coming on and explaining this word to us.
Thank you.
And thank all of you for continuing to send in submissions. And please keep them coming. You can message me at the World in Words Facebook page, or you can even call. Yes, call. 617-903-8818. That's 617-903-8818. Or you can even tweet at me. So many options. I'm on Twitter, at Porzucki. That's P-O-R-Z-U-C-K-I, my last name. Thanks for listening. Be back soon.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor.